Hello and welcome to the Leaders in Supply Chain podcast. I am your host, Radu Palamariu, and it is my pleasure to have with us today Professor Annie Koh from the Singapore Management University. Prof. Annie has an impressive track record in driving tripartite discussions between the education sector, government, and private institutions in close areas to supply chain. In her position as Director of the Financial Training Institute, the Center for Professional Studies, the International Trading Center, as well as the Business Families Institute at the Singapore Management University. Prof. Koh is also a member of the board of Prudential Insurance Company Singapore. She is the chair of the Finance and Investment Committee. She sits on the GovTech Singapore board. She is part of the Monetary Authority of Singapore board, as well as the Singapore Central Provident board. And she serves on the Skills Future HR Tripartite Committee, as well as the HR Certification Task Force. Prof. Annie, pleasure to have you with us today, and thank you for the time.
Thank you very much, Radu. I think that's too long an introduction.
I've barely touched the surface of all the things that you've done, but we had to distill it. Maybe let's start by asking you to tell us a little bit about some of the projects that you've spearheaded at the Singapore Management University. I know that you have a trading center that you've kind of funded. You have the Business Families Institute. Tell us a little bit about these projects and how you started.
I think let me focus more on the International Trading Institute. The reason is very simple. I think the questions that are coming when you announce this podcast are very much related to trading. And as you know, this is Singapore's 200th birthday. So, you know, since the discovery of Singapore as a village, and Sir Stamford Raffles saw in Singapore when it discovered in 1819 that we have a deep sea harbour. And so it would be the perfect spot for building a port. But beyond port, in the last 200 years, we have International Enterprise Singapore, the old name for Enterprise Singapore today, where they actually said we should have a downstream trading hub. And the reason is very simple, because no port is effective if we do not have a collation of trading companies. So in the year 2006, as I recall very clearly, I was wearing the hat of the associate dean of my business school, and my major is in finance. So when the IE Singapore, which is International Enterprise Singapore, people came to see us, they said many of the trading companies are actually having traders coming from overseas. And it's not because we are against having overseas talent, but are there any institutions in Singapore building the pipeline of trading talent? And I think you must give it to our government. They think long-term. They almost behave like business families because they have a long-term horizon in mind. And we cannot talk about sustainability of our trading hub if we don't pay attention to preparing the pipeline of talent. So in my role as Associate Dean, I put my hand and I said, it's very good that you have this ambition to the government, but if I do not have a group of companies that are willing to step up, then it's a chicken and egg issue, because I will train people who will know commodities trading in depth, and they will come out and graduate and be wondering, are there jobs for them? Will there be roles for them? So I need a tripartite relationship. I need the government to sponsor some kind of a seed funding so that we can get the curriculum design. But at the same time, I need an ecosystem of trading partners who will then take our students, and it's beyond just taking courses in the classroom. Our students got to see trading come alive. Our students have to be attached as interns. And of course, down the road, they must be then sourced as, you know, a pipeline where people are actually recruiting from this pool. Long story short, we celebrated ITI's anniversary, 10th anniversary last year. So it's been 10 wonderful years. And the tripartite relationship really works when it comes to developing talent. The government helped me in the first 2 years with some seed funding so that I could find faculty resources. And because commodities trading is so specialized, you cannot expect university professors to know this. So we parked the trading track under finance major, and the students are required to do finance. But in addition, they have 3 credit courses related to trading, but not specifically targeted at trading. So things like trade finance, things like derivatives, things like shipping business, those are for credit. Then on top of their other finance electives. But so much of commodities trading, it's about product knowledge. And my university faculty, including myself, we don't have it. So we turn to the ecosystem. And we tell the ecosystem that you will get talent trained for LNG, talent trained for metals, talent trained for crude oil trading, or even emissions trading. But please give me your resources. Send your top trader to class, and they will be interacting with the students. So we did something innovative. We set up a series of non-credit courses. And everyone was laughing at us, I recall. How many students will even come to this class? Because it's not for credit. Why would they even be here? Our students did us proud. They actually sign up for the non-credit courses because they want to hear from the big shell trader who trades crude. They want to hear from the trophy trader who is going under Concordia then, who trades agricultural commodities, because they know that they will be in the radar of all these wonderful leaders coming in, and that's the best way to be spotted. Yes. And so that they could be recruited. So today, we have close to about 300 alumni. 70% of them are still having careers
within the industry.
And downstream is trading. So in the year 2013, Maritime Port Authority came to us. So that reports under Ministry of Transport, whereas trading reports under Ministry of Trade and Industry. So different ministries have already heard about the things we do differently at SMU. So MPA came to us and said, how about helping us and start a pipeline of talent who knows maritime?
Yes.
Because you cannot do downstream and not learn midstream and upstream.
Yes.
And we said, yes, we are ready to go, because my dean in the School of Economics told me, you did so well for the dean at business school. Please do something for us. So we started a maritime economics track. And that was about 4 years ago. And we have students who are not only doing maritime economics, they get a one term in Copenhagen Business School, fully funded through the MPA funding. So that is the beauty of tripartite, Radu. The Singapore government put the money where their mouth is, because to grow talent, you must have patient capital. On top of that, they bring the ecosystem. So I have students who are now in Pacific International Lines. I have students in Maersk. I have students at Cleverness, and they are still working there. And then we are hearing the next big thing. All my trading firms, all my maritime firms are all saying we are getting disrupted by technology. It's not good enough now to just have trading skill and maritime economics forecasting skills. We need operations people. So even as I'm giving you this interview, we have just launched a maritime business operations track that's going to sit under my operations management major. So in a nutshell, universities are strategic partners of the country. But we cannot do things if it's only top down. We can only make magic happen if we have the whole community coming on board. So every one of those companies who believed in us, even when we were just a blueprint of ideas, I want to say a big thank you to all of them. My ecosystem of close to 60 trading firms, my ecosystem of close to 20 maritime companies, and now I'm appealing to the logistics and supply chain community as we launch the MBOT, which is the Maritime Business Operations Track.
Super. But I mean, it's fascinating, actually. I knew a little bit of the story, but thank you for sharing the details with us. And I would love to find out a little bit more, because definitely now you've come a long way.
Yes.
You've done more than 10 years of this different tracks, and with success, you know, success breeds success, and more people come on board. And of course, you have case studies and testimonials of people who've made it and now they have successful careers. But I'm just curious if somebody listening to the podcast from another part of the world is just trying to get started, and not everybody is as progressive as the Singapore government, depending on the country that we're in. What were some of the keys to success, right? Because maybe there's a couple of of keys right there. One is, how do you get on board the private sector, right? And the 60 companies that you initially got on board. Maybe we can look a little bit into that. And the second one is also on the I mean, the government of Singapore is very forward looking, but maybe there's some other elements, key elements to success at the beginning.
So that's a great question, Radu. I think essentially the private sector today are actually much more engaged than the many years ago. I think a lot of private sectors start to realize that we have to co-create talent together. It's always been a big issue. And in the past, they just go to the career center and say, I need so many undergraduates, and you know, any major will do, any degree will do. But today, there is no time to waste. And many companies are no longer taking people and just doing in-house because they don't have the luxury of time. So if you go out to a private sector, one of the key success factors is do go out to the private sector and say, we are willing to experiment. We are willing to co-create. We will have like the Senate and a lot of the you know, committees that we have to go through, jump through hoops if we have to launch a new program. But a track is not a new program. A track is only a track within
part
a
of
major.
A program. Yes,
absolutely.
Yes, yes.
So don't try to change the world by going to say, I'm going to have a new undergraduate degree, a new master's degree focused on logistics or supply chain. I think that makes it very much more difficult because you have many hoops to climb. But if you do something which is relatively painless in a way and not rocking and shaking the boat, and you know, bring in partners who says, we are willing to come part way with you, because many of our faculty may not be in a position to teach a lot of the applied courses.
Yes.
So allow for the possibility that many of the courses that you are proposing for the students to take may not be counted as credits.
Yes.
So it comes out as some kind of certificate of completion, or you could be a study work project. Who says that learning only takes place in the classroom? So a lot of learning can take place because it's outside of the classroom and students are doing a project, and in the process of doing, they are learning. And of course, in that process, you are also coaching them. So you have a chance to identify the talent that fits your culture or has the right competencies and entrepreneurial spirit, depending on which value chain you are at right now. So if you are a young startup, you definitely could do with a lot of young talent. If you are, you know, steady growth, but you still need young eyes to come in, and you have your own succession challenge, because many in the maritime and logistics are actually having grey hair or no hair. So shouldn't it be your responsibility to also have a pipeline of next generation people? And my role is actually, the more I learn about trading, shipping and logistics and supply chain, I think it's an exciting area. I think it's a great area to go out to the young talent and say, this can be a great career pathway. Why are y'all not looking at it, right? And in the past, a lot of our students go to banking, the brainy ones, you know, they all go there. So our role is, if this is important for my country, work with me, talk to the private sector and say, let's solve this problem together. How do we build a pipeline of talent collaboratively?
Yes. And that's a fantastic sharing, actually. And indeed, it is, I think, it, particularly from where we sit as the human resources side, and obviously we work more with companies to find them the right talent at a certain level. But there is a push and there's a move, and there's much more excitement than ever before in the area of supply chain. And also education is slowly but surely changing, as you said. And I loved your analogy or your sharing in terms of start small. You don't need to rock the boat. You don't need to revamp the whole curriculum of the university, because also that is very difficult to do. Even the professors, as you rightfully mentioned, may not have the skills or the knowledge to overnight pick up this new subjects, but you can do it in a small way that over time picks up.
Yes.
So I really like that. And I wanted to kind of build upon that and ask the question from one of our listeners, which was along the side of how and what's your thoughts around best practices and wishes for both students and sponsoring companies when it comes to internships, to graduating programs, to, you know, building up that skill set and also kind of getting the students on board the company on that journey.
So I think that's a great question. I think it was from Matthew. And Matt, you're spot on that it takes two hands to clap. So, you know, if you want to attract students, the students have to know who you are. So I think the fact that we actually have the non-credit classes was great, because many of the people who came in to teach for the students are actually leaders from the company. So because it's non-credit, they don't have to grade exams. They just have to tell the stories of why they are still in the job 30, 40 years later. And you know, what are the future opportunities? Then, of course, they learn something solid. They can bring their team in and say, okay, we want to show to you that, you know, you need not come into the company at the trading level at the moment. We need you to learn trading ops. And the more you learn about ops, the better a trader you are. So it addresses expectations. You don't have kids coming to your company thinking that I want to be in your shoes immediately. And I think those are very important lessons. So people were asking me in one of the questions about mentoring. Mentoring can take place through such programs. You could actually have professional leaders who come in and share. And in that process, given their, you know, their experience, they will be great business coaches. And many of our students are inspired to join the industry because of all these wonderful leaders who came in to speak to us. Now, of course, there is also a responsibility to taking an intern. So we also tell our company there is a little template. And so the intern that comes in, we like to see that there is some kind of a structured program. And therefore, at the end of the 3 months, 4 months, or 6 months, some of our students go all the way to 6 months. They actually would say, I have learned such and such and such. I've done this project and that project. Because to them, that is part of their whole CV. And therefore, it adds tremendous value. So we've actually had very good companies who sit down with the student and then draw up a structured program for them, even within the internships. So best practices is there's accountability, there's responsibility, there's a certain discipline to internship programs as well.
So thank you, Prof, for that answer. And I love also the flexibility that I know we had a discussion in terms of the internships, right, that you mentioned offline, that, for example, in the Singapore Management University, and it's also quite frequent today in other universities where you have that type of, you can take off those 6 months, you go join the company, then you come back, you finish your degree, and then you have the diploma. And a lot of times that brings, most times actually, that brings a lot of gravitas and depth to your CV and to your curriculum. And it kind of also links the concepts together, if I am to think. It's kind of, in many ways, I think of the analogy of people that go to an MBA without working experience versus people that go there with working experience. And it makes a lot more sense. And that's why most MBA schools, actually, the reputable ones, enforce it. Like, look, work for 5 years, then come, because then actually it kind of links in your mind. Otherwise, it's kind of just a theoretical exercise where it may or may not exactly connect dots. So I'd love to kind of move to the part where we talk a little bit about digital skills, right, and digital literacy. There's a question. Keith Carter is a professor at the NUS, the National University of Singapore. Great friend, great professor and practitioner. And he was asking, how can we increase digital literacy? Because as a skill set, as also as a mindset almost today, it's just crucial, fundamental.
Yes. So I'm happy to have a fellow, academic asking this question. And Keith is quite right that today there's an urgency. So if you look at Minister Heng, my finance minister's budget speech a couple of weeks ago, he actually emphasized that this is a set of skills that we need, not just for students, but even for our citizens, as Singapore moves towards being a smart nation. And then, of course, for businesses, because this is the only way to compete today. So, you know, we can grow the current skills, but since we have curriculum and we have students with us, we must also quickly go upstream and get to the students. So I think even at the secondary schools, the primary schools, the high schools, there is a big agenda now about learning to be digital very quickly from day one. And so therefore, the word quickly is key. Now, digital skills should be a life skill, right, Keith? So we have five senses. Why don't we say we should have a digital sense? And I think for students, for children born in the year 2000, they are already digital natives. So there is no need for us to worry about the baggage or the legacy. But even my 1980s, 1990 born students today, they need to update and upgrade. And I think for the ones who are in their 40 and above, they are the ones who are struggling. So everywhere across different layers of Singapore's human resources, we need capital injection to make us human capital. So investment is critical right now. Now, the young ones could probably pick up digital skills quickly. The older ones will probably take a long, longer. And then, you know, they probably have to ask themselves, what aspect of the digital skills can I learn that allows me to be creating value? I cannot relearn everything. I cannot unlearn everything, but maybe I have a companion. And so we feel very strongly that, in fact, we should match the younger cohort with the current cohort. So learning can be on a collaborative basis, intergenerational. So I love the suggestions. I would love to hear from the audience. But one of the things that we are doing right now is about a year and a half ago, our Ministry of Manpower. So now you will realize I don't just talk to one ministry. The Ministry of Manpower spoke to us about a lot of our mid-career professionals that are getting displaced. And the sector they used to be in may have become disrupted. So in banking, some of the middle office roles are going to other countries where the cost of labor is much lower. So you might now have a group of people with some domain skills, actually very strong domain skills, but they are getting disrupted. And so they need to learn new skills. So jobs will go away, but skills will not go away. You just have to learn new skills. So we propose, because of International Trading Institute, we propose to the government that actually if you give us 1 year and we could match the mid-career hires to the growing companies that need some kind of help and support to digitalize and grow wholesale trade, these individuals could be retooled and reskilled to help those growing companies. And the government heard us loud and clear. So we have now become one of the institutes that is offering professional conversion programs. And we do bring in people from the industry to help put digital skills into the curriculum. So trade digitalization. How do we migrate from e-invoicing, from traditional invoicing to e-invoicing?
Paperless, yeah.
Bingo. So grow paperless, but without having to do the coding yourself. Because at the mid-career, this is not the time for them to learn about coding skills. And the young ones could probably learn that. But today, software as a service, so everything can be open source. So you could start knowing who else is in this area, who are the vendors that they could hear and then bring this vendor context to their company to help them digitalize. So I think this is the way forward. No running away. Digital skills will be part of our curriculum. That is a given. But even digital skills need to be upgraded even as we go along.
Yes. And to build upon the question in terms of, so digital skills, but, you know, looking at the future, and you touched upon, you know, kind of human, it's almost like the human element and the human skills. Tell us a little bit about your view on soft skills, right? Because, you know, digital skills, certain things you can pick up fairly quickly or not.
Right.
Soft skills is another category.
I am so glad, Radu, you asked this, because I think the more you digitalize, the more you need to be human. And that has become my mantra, because I have seen that technology alone does not create value. So we are actually seeing a lot of tech people increasingly saying we need to work with interdisciplinary and multidisciplinary teams. And I'm so delighted with this question, because a few hours ago, I have my research vice dean from one of my schools mentioning that, you know, we have psychologists, you know, from social science. Where would they be if today everyone is emphasizing only digital skills? And I say, oh, you'll be shocked. I've been speaking to the Facebook, the Google companies of the world today, and they've been telling me that we can no longer launch any new service or new product without a multidisciplinary team. So they will have data analysts who sit side by side with a psychology major, because you have to tell from the data, big data, and turn it into useful ideas. So data analytics cannot be done without knowing how the human beings behave. And how to influence all right, human beings towards certain direction if you want them to, you know, buy a certain product, buy a certain service. So I do see that hard skills people need to learn soft skills, and soft skill majors need to appreciate the role of technology and digitalization in changing the way we consume, the way we buy, the way we live. So therefore, increasingly, it's going to be less and less like big majors or functional alone, but greater cross-interdisciplinary learning.
Yes.
And here I have to jump in and say that's why SMU continue to experiment even today. A few years ago, many of our faculty are actually saying, I can't teach one discipline without another faculty teaching the other discipline together with me. So we've launched something called SMU X, and X stands for extra. Extra because an accounting professor will then say, I need an IS professor to co-teach with me, and we design a program around accounting information systems. And then we, our students will not get much value if they're learning it from a textbook. So we will go out to a group of companies and say, do you have existing projects? Do you have some problem that we can scope? And then you take this problem and we give it to a group of students where in the process of taking that class, they actually solve that problem for you. And they have to work in teams. So we have accounting students and information system in the class. Now, it takes a lot of work for two faculty to teach together. It's already a lot of work for one faculty. But imagine two faculty from two different disciplines, team teaching. But they learn too that their disciplines have now got impact, learning, and implications for application because of this merging of two disciplines. And we have got some fantastic projects that the students have worked on. And to incentivize and make it even more risky for the student, it's a group project and they get a group grade. And the grade is the only thing that they have from taking this class.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. So we dare to experiment, and the companies that have come in on this journey with us have actually told us that they are amazed at some of the wonderful projects and ideas that the students have brought to their own management team.
Have you had some success stories of being implemented as well? Or maybe
totally.
You can share something?
Yeah. So we actually have a lot of these companies actually got their whole team to come, and then they said to the students, can you then quickly now in the next 6 months, all right, be our interns.
Wow.
And implement the projects.
Wow, that's fantastic.
Yes.
That's really a proof that they've done a fantastic job there.
So it's learning by doing. And then they are really one step closer to the company. And in turn, the company also know that this group, they can now watch them and decide that if they finally graduate, who do they give the employment contract to? So our students literally dare to take the risk with us. So SMU X, it's not across the board. We must have willing faculty, willing companies, and willing students. But they dare. They all step up to it. And our next wave is to do SMU X overseas. So it's called SMU XO. Don't you like the name XO, you know? Like the cognac, you know? So the X overseas is critical because in minister's speech, many Singaporeans know how to do local projects, but companies are now employing talent to do overseas projects, Radu. So you can't talk about trading, maritime and supply chain if you don't cross borders. So we want our students not to have digital skills and functional skills alone. We want them to have cross-cultural skills. And the only way to do cross-cultural is to work with the localization, to work with teams of people who are from Myanmar, Vietnam, Indonesia. Southeast Asia is just right behind our backyard. And there has to be a one ASEAN. It's not good enough to be one Singapore. Singapore's relevance is pivoted on the relevance to the whole ASEAN region. So for me, I'm so excited because I'm looking to my ecosystem of companies now and say, look, we know you like SMU X, but now you stretch with us. Do you have a company project that is overseas? So our students will learn in class, then they will go there and help you implement. go international with my students so that you can also achieve your own objective of being international. So we are moving mountains a little bit, but we want real good use cases. So the more we can express this in, you know, in the script form, in telling people, and that it's not me telling, I would love that companies who have taken my students to be my ambassadors. So my students are the ambassadors, but now I demand even more. Companies where we have solved the problems for them, with them, please be the first to tell people about it. Please be the first to admit that some of those ideas are great and that it's like outside looking in. And the more you engage students, the more you are engaging your future consumers, your future partners, and your future employees. So then you are also learning about what you need to change in order to attract talent of the future.
Yeah, it's whilst you were sharing, it made me think, because when I was a student, I was part of students' organizations. So I was part of two international ones back then. One is called ISEC, and I think they have a, I mean, for sure, they have a presence in, I don't know if they have it, I think they have SMU, they have, NUS, and NTU in all the three major universities in Singapore. And they have some fantastic projects as well, international internships and all of that. And they do it, it's run by students for students.
Yeah.
A very interesting concept. But basically what you've just described is taking it one step further, where you actually involve the faculties and the professors to basically actively create those and co-create those projects with the students, which just takes it to much greater level, right? Because the students' organization can touch, I don't know, maybe 100 students, but if you do it right between faculties, you touch even the lives of even more students, which is great. And I'd love to also make a segue back to the with the part with the soft skills, because there was a very specific question that Henrik had, and I know him personally and his former background of organizational development and psychology, and he was specifically asking how come coaching, facilitation, and mediation is not part of university's curriculum, because he thinks that those three skills are very relevant to the workforce. You mentioned that you like the teams to work together, so obviously they learn those skills, but he's actually putting it in the context, maybe we should have it as part of the curriculum itself.
I would love to meet Henrik one day, but you know, actually in our core curriculum, we do have, we started our, you know, undergrad 19 years ago. It's, you know, modeled with American style education, and we took quite a big piece from Wharton School, and they have the leadership and team building as a core course. And then the next level of elective is called leadership and team mentoring, which is another level. So we do have students who learn about LTB, and then they become mentors to the level one student. But that is very much learning within the SMU undergraduate community. In fact, today, we are now seeing even more mentoring needed, not student mentoring other students, but actually outside people mentoring our students. And so when I mentioned SMUX just now, not only must the faculty have oversight of the project, but every project will have an application to a company. So there must be somebody in the company who is the sponsor of the project. And he or she has to sit down with our students to mentor them. So business mentoring of project or project mentoring is already taking place. Now, of course, it will be even better if the students have life coaches and all that. And we currently don't have it in our curriculum in a big way. But before the students graduate, they do have a coach to kind of sit with them and think about what are their life goals and what are some of the career opportunities that they are looking at. And that goes under our Career Services Center. So it's a bit like a finishing touch, all right? But the more we work with the industry, the greater the opportunities are for many of our industry professionals and partners to be a source for our future coaching of projects, of our students. But, you know, we haven't formalized it into a curriculum.
And I'd love to touch upon, you mentioned the American education system. I'd love to touch upon cost, because that's a big one. And maybe we can share also with the audience. I'm not familiar with exactly how much the cost is in Singapore, but I know that in in America is crazy. In the US, I think you can up to $100,000 cost for graduating from university. So basically, the question from one of our audience was, how do you cope with the increasing cost? I don't know if it's exactly the same as Singapore, but there is a cost associated to it. And what's the ROI in the context of constant change that we're being faced today?
Good question. So I must say that at the undergraduate level, which has about 8,000 of our students on a four-year program, the government is our biggest source of subsidies, right? So many of our students actually get a very good quality undergraduate degree, still costing some funds, but it does not break the bank. And they are allowed to go on student loan and then pay without interest over a few years after their graduation. So I think at the undergraduate level, Singapore government definitely has done very well. We are not the only university. Six other universities are autonomously run, but government funded. So the subvention is in place for undergraduate. But you only get that at undergraduate level. Once you want to go for another degree, then it's on your own. And Radu, you're right. I think in Singapore right now, an MBA on average is close to 100,000 Sing as well. Yes, so you actually have a range depending on the brand name. All right. Many of the people who are in our MBA program are not necessarily from Singapore. So I think the Singapore brand is still a good brand. And so about more than 60% of our student profile is actually from other countries. And they are hoping that maybe with an MBA from a Singapore-branded university, they could get jobs here. They could actually apply the learning and then they'll have jobs here. And if it's a generic MBA that you're talking about, actually most of the people's first degree is not from business. So therefore, they needed the MBA in order to round them up and have a set of fungible skills that could help them manage people, manage resources, manage company. So Singapore Management University is not about a business school. It's actually about giving you management capabilities so that you could manage non-profit as well. You could have an MBA to become a non-profit leader. So the idea here is you are investing in yourself. And so given the fact that it's not subsidized at the university level, therefore the university have to put in true costs. And so the undergraduate is actually expensive too, but they are not paying the true cost because of the subvention, right? So the question that actually came from your audience is, why would anybody want to invest 100K? You know, do they get the return on investment? And that's a fair question. And interestingly, the market still do recruit MBAs. And I think it's not just because of an MBA, it's that whole holistic portfolio of the individual. So many of our MBA students come from certain domain expertise. And after the MBA, they hope to get a better job, maybe a much more leadership role instead of the functional skills role. So if you look at the rankings, and we are now in one of the top 50 now of the Asian university, a lot of the drivers of the ranking is between the time you joined the program and the time you graduated, is there an improvement of pay? And there is, right? The data doesn't lie. People do get that return on investment. And so the market is still signaling that the MBA is of value. Yeah. Now, that doesn't mean that MBA is the only master's degree. So we actually have different masters. And so we have masters in applied finance, masters in wealth management, masters in innovation. And today, one of the hottest masters is masters in business IT.
Wow.
Where you marry business and IT.
Technology.
Yes. Mm-hmm. So today's world is where you see yourself, where is your next career pathway, and then you look at what you need to get there. And usually the masters give you the credential. Now, of course, on top of the masters, if you have also worked on related projects during that period in which you are investing in the masters, I think there is still room. But increasingly, and Hendrik is right, people are weighing the costs and the benefits. And they will say that, what happens if I don't take the masters? What would show up as my talent portfolio? then I would say you can go for certification programs. You can also learn from online. I have many, many people who tell me that they actually learn data analytics online. So Udemy, EDX, they are all out there. But I think it's not the brain and passive learning that gives you the edge. It's as you learn, do you have a place to apply the learning? And I think some of our programs that are offered, you know, where the government is investing in lifelong learning, it's no longer for the next wave to be just a classroom. We would love to have people join a company and sit down with their learning and development person and say, what can I do to make myself credible for my next, all right, jump in career pathway? What do I need to invest right now? And will you co-invest with me? So HR may pay for some of the training, but the individual must take ownership for his or her training. Mm. And that's why lifelong learning is such an important component of Singapore's blueprint for human capital development. Because that degree alone does not make you an effective job person or effective talent for the company that you are joining.
It's interesting. Actually, Mac had a second question, and you basically touched upon it so nicely that I'm going to jump into it, even if it was for later. So basically, he was saying the same thing, but he was arguing, and his argument was that if you do spend indeed a few hundred hours worth via all these online portals where you can pick up skills, right? Udemy, UiPath, which is for the robotic process automation. You can learn Python, RPA, whatever it is. Plus, you manage somehow through connections or network or whatever it is that you real manage yourself, which is, nevertheless, it is harder to get into a company, a apprenticeship or internship that can potentially better prepare you for a future logistics career or supply chain career than basically an education system. I think the argument comes depending on, because you've shared with us all the great initiatives that happened in Singapore and in... But Singapore and me being here for many, many years, but coming from from a different type of a system maybe, which is not as advanced, and I think a lot of systems around the world are not as advanced. So Singapore, I think, is one of the more forward-thinking. A lot of educational systems are not yet there. So I guess where he's coming from is like, yes, but where is that balance? Because it may be that it's bad, and there's, Bill Gates never graduated, and there's a lot of entrepreneurs. We have all these success stories, right, where they kind of built a company and never graduated from school because they had no time. So where is that? How do you decide, right, what is better for you? And if I can just jump and kind of follow my own thread of mind, and then I'll give you the microphone. It's almost, to me, it's also, it seems or it feels just based on the candidates that we interview from an HR perspective and the recruitment business, that it also depends greatly on the personality, because some people are really good, and it's typically more the entrepreneurial type, are really good with doing things and getting things going, whilst others like to have some sort of a formal structured type of an approach, and then it works better to be in a more formalized setup. So that tends to also kind of play a part. But
so I think today there is no one pathway. And I think I'm so glad in a way that our Minister of Education recently have stopped the idea of streaming. All right, of putting you into the fast track, the normal track, and the not so normal track. And he's saying, like, depending on your level of ability to learn, you might go from one to another, and you're picking up your portfolio of courses. And it probably make things less clear, but the future is ambiguous. It's a VUCA world, it's volatile, uncertain, complex and ambiguous. We live with it. It's going to be like this. So many people might have like a functional, major because they like structure, right? But as they get to career pathways, they need to go back to different institutions, and I did not say universities, to acquire the add-on. And the add-on can be learned in different ways. It could be a corporate that has a structured program for you. It could be you got to go out there and sign up for the program. So even my professional conversion program that has government subsidy, I cannot do everything on my own. So I work with ICC Academy, where they actually give us an e-learning module. And we make the students adult learn E. Learn in your own time, own target, but just that within the 6 months, you must complete the export-import certification. So they are starting to learn at 45 online. And that's why we said you learn digital, because that is going to be your curriculum. You are going to have that certificate. If not, I will not give you my final diploma in trading, right? So universities must also adjust. Universities of the future may have to work with many other partners where there will be portability. Maybe I can let part of my curriculum be done by somebody else who is going to be better at training, all right, the future graduates of tomorrow. Maybe I can collaborate with them. I have content and they have the pipes and tubes to reach out to the masses. So therefore, there's some kind of a credentialing system. So right now, we are still experimenting. Some of our courses are going to be bite-sized and they will be stackable towards a degree. But at the moment, you can take it as certificate modules. And then if you make admissions criteria, you can become a degree when you trade it in later on. So different strokes for different folks. And I think education seemingly takes a longer time to change. So I think one of the questions is like, there's a big divide, you know, between the world out there and many of the universities. And I think nothing hits universities faster than a shrinking population and other alternative non-traditional offerers of courses and content. So some universities in the US are also very worried because they may have no more young students. They may end up having a lot of older students who are coming back for retraining. And therefore, maybe they should not get so fixated about offering more degrees, but should be offering more competency-based type programs that can help people reskill, retool, and prepare for jobs of the future. So I think this conversation will continue. Fortunately, in logistics space, the market has been very responsive. I am personally not only just working for the university with my ITT, my international trading track, my maritime track, and my maritime business operations track. Those are all my undergraduates. I also sit on the board of SCALA. And SCALA stands for Supply Chain and Logistics Academy, which is housed under one of Singapore's largest logistics firm, YCH Group. So they have footprints in different countries as well. And they actually have stepped up as one of the professional trainer for logistics space. So we outsource one module of our professional conversion program to SCALA. Because not only do our mid-career hires need to learn downstream trading, upstream transportation, they need to understand logistics as well. So that one module, they will go to SCALA to learn, and then there is an assessment and we will count it towards our diploma. So I'm very collaborative, Radu. I like to believe that that's the future of everything. And logistics is not about learning in the classroom. So many of our PCP, Professional Conversion Program candidates, and SCALA's own Professional Conversion Program candidates are all matched to jobs first. So they learn by doing. So the future is about applying. And the relevance is when you apply something, it's like you got skin in the game. The learning turns alive. The learning becomes, oh, that which I've learned about trade facilitation, my boss is now asking me, all right, to send this SKU of goods to this country. Do we have a free trade agreement with them? How do I get it into that special list so that I don't have to pay tariffs, so that I can have a market? So the whole learning comes alive. And I think that's the best way to learn, whether you are mid-career, relearning, or even an undergraduate who are learning.
It's practical. It's practical, it's pragmatic. You can see exactly where your whatever it is that you're learning can be applied immediately. So. Yeah. Absolutely. And I, based on what you just shared, and we had Yossi Sheffi, who's the Dean of MIT for Transportation and Logistics. And we had a very interesting discussion at that point in terms of the future of education. As you rightfully said, and ultimately it's to be seen what it is going to be. I think nobody actually has a concrete idea what it is, but probably things like online learning, things like collaboration between the different tripartite agreements between different parties and the three elements, government, education, and private sector, will continue to be a cornerstone of making it work.
Yes.
And back to Yossi, he was sharing that he's all for online, and MIT under his watch started these online courses, and they have MIT X, and he even put up different centers of logistics, opened up, I think, 5 or 6 all around
the
world.
Done.
So he's done fantastic. But he said, you know, Radu, I'm struggling with some of my colleagues because they're not that open, and they're really keeping it close to their chests because they've been used to teaching in a certain way, and that's, you know, the old way, which you also have to pay a lot of money for it. And I'm like, I'm all for opening it. Maybe I'm too open at the same time. But I guess, Prof. Anin, this is the reality that we live in. And as you said, I mean, unless you are able to adapt, also as a university, you stand the risk of not having students anymore, because people will find other ways of learning.
Exactly.
And if it is not practical, if it is not collaborative, if it is not truly adding value, you know, a diploma is as good as a diploma, but at some point there's going to be other ways of doing it.
I think a lot of people have the aspiration, they always wanted to have a university degree. But, you know, we do have great examples of people, like you said, who are actually self-made men, and they learn by doing, because they have to create value. So many mouths are dependent on them. But coming to an education, we cannot be everything to everybody. So there are different reasons why people still need a degree and would want a degree. So time to sit back and think. So I still have a lot of mid-career people who can afford it. And they say, I'm going to take 2 years to learn something. And there are even a lot of mid-career who are very strong leaders, and they all want to come back and do a PhD or applied, doctorate degree. And I like that, because they actually said, we are coming back to the university because it is an institution of higher learning. So I'm not here to learn a trade anymore, because I've done the trade. I want time to think. I want time to put all my learning before into a piece of thought leadership and contribute to the world, or maybe learning a little bit, just pushing the envelope, but I would have a part to play contributing back. So I think we shouldn't just sweep everything under the carpet and throw the baby with the bathwater. I think universities have a role to create thinking adults. Not that you don't think if you don't join a university, but to ask questions, to ask what are the big questions, what are the big problems. And today we can't solve the big problems on our own. So digitalization has made inclusiveness possible. So yesterday I was at one of the Future of Trade Forum, and I love it that increasingly all my startups are looking towards, you know, the bigger boys, because startups on their own is no longer thinking of disrupting. Their value is in helping the bigger boy, and they work cohesively together. So we are seeing that convergence now. We are seeing startups who actually say, I know that my exit may not be this big boy, but I wanted a use case to show that I have value for this big company. And big companies are also saying that my legacy system cannot change quick enough, but let me work with a startup. So I'm seeing meeting of minds, I'm seeing meeting of cultures, and I think one of my ambition is all institutions of learning should come together. That will be great if we can do it in little Singapore. I would love to talk to Keith, you know, and see how we can collaborate. All right, maybe in non-degree, because it's easier to do collaboration if it's non-degree. And then we can look at how can we help the region. All right, how can we help as our companies grow global? Maybe I could have Keith offer courses in his digital side, and then we offer courses in the trade side to help our institutions in ASEAN. Many of them are hungry to learn. And then we work with a partner university who can turn it into their language, because a lot of times we are fragmented. English is very natural in Singapore, but some of the countries we go to, they still need the local language. So we have a university partner who can then translate and bring it down and make it more available, because technology is now making it more available. So I think human capital is the theme. It can be human capital within your own country, within your own sector, but the power of digitalization is you can touch more human beings by working together. So I definitely hope to work with more people. If they hear this podcast, I'm more than happy, more than ready.
Yeah, I'm sure. I'm sure. I mean, and we'll include your contacts so that they can reach out to you. Yeah. And just before we go, I'd love to address also this question, because it's a big one, and it's on sustainability. And Corina was asking that education, I mean, she was kind of framing it that education gets a more and more important meaning today because of the globalization, and we have a lot of different things, you know, peace, justice, strong institutions that we need to look after. But also it's the kind of merit or almost obligation that education should have in order to contribute to a sustainable development of us as a society, if you may. How can we achieve that? How can education achieve that?
Oh, I love the question from Corina. Is she related to you? Her last name is Radu. No, I'm just teasing her.
She's Romanian.
Yeah, she's Romanian. I love the question. And I think, Corina, you'll be happy to know that as recent as last month, beginning of the year, my business school, my dean, Jerry George, have just announced that sustainability is a major in our business school. And even today, when I look at all my companies that have supported us, they are coming to us now and say, Annie, it's great that you have done your curriculum that has non-credit in product knowledge, but going forward, can you also include a non-credit sustainability component? Because more and more companies are looking at sustainability. So I just came back from Kuala Lumpur, and one of my palm oil plantations company, who own huge footprints, and she said the time is right for the whole palm oil industry to come together, not because the buyers are demanding it of us, but because our talent do not want to join us if they think that we are the ones, the culprit that's burning down forests, you know, and not planting back the trees. But we now have data that we are collecting from the farms. And the more we work across the value chain, the supply chain that you're so proud about, Radu, if we can get all the elements in the supply chain to collect data and track the traceability with blockchain today, and with AI to interpret the data, we can actually show that there is a certification that we are definitely paying attention to sustainability. So my new president, Prof. Lily Kong, has actually taken on the role of relooking our whole curriculum. And our curriculum today is pivoted as a core curriculum before you do your electives, around three C's. And the first C is on capabilities, which is very much driven by your majors and your tracks. There are some functional skills that every student should still need to learn. But the second one is about communities. That means you cannot be an educated person if you don't think beyond yourself. So the community is critical. You should be doing corporate social responsibility. You should be doing things that build a more sustainable future for the whole world and for your own village, and not just the world alone. And then the third is about civilizations. How can you be a global citizen if you are so micro, if you're only a frog looking up your own well? So civilizations is to create cross-cultural awareness. And what better way than our ASEAN backyard? We have 10 countries, and so many of our students look to the Europe, look to America, but don't even know enough about ASEAN. So I think if we could hit the all three C's in the next few years of our core curriculum, we should hopefully be addressing some of that sustainability question. They are the future workers, they are the future consumers, they are the future partners. They will require it, they will insist on it for the whoever they are going to be working with. So I think I'm not giving up hope on the current pool of human beings and people, but if we invest right in our future citizen who is a global citizen, who sees a compatible, sustainable, you know, world that we all live in together, there is hope, Karina, for this to happen.
And as we know, it's been studied, and you know, with Generation Y and the millennials, and I don't know how they call the last generation, the demand for basically sustainability and meaning in work and in whatever it is that they do is so high that it's just incredibly important that we include that. And I would love also to kind of wrap up with a more personal question, because I think now, you know, the audience knows you a little bit better, Prof. Annie, and then you know, your energy is contagious, and I think you've shared a lot of great stories, great projects, and I think the common theme that comes across very strongly is one is collaboration and maybe community, in the sense of let's do this together, let's involve the different players in the ecosystem and let's build it together.
Yes.
Probably another theme that I've heard again and again was, you know, let's be open, let's be creative, let's explore, let's try out new things, right? So that that part. But maybe tell a little bit to the audience also a little bit about yourself. How, because you know, you have this energy and you have this passion, and you know, how did it come about? And you've had a very successful career in the academia. So I don't know, maybe very shortly, you know, how did
I think a lot of people see me as an academic who is always challenging the current, because the current needs to change, but most people don't realize it. I actually have a career that is not in academic in the past. So after my first degree in economics and social studies, actually I was a banker. So I was 4.5 years a banker in DBS, and I went straight into treasury. So I was a forex trader. Yes, I like the way you smile, Radu. So that's a part of my life you didn't realize. And I have 4.5 fantastic years where we are actually international from day one. Because in Singapore, you don't deal, local, you deal international. So I think I love the word international. Internationalization should be in the DNA of every individual, because that will make us a much more open person. And there will be an upcoming announcement soon where ITI, we have been tasked with the Skills Future Framework for Internationalization. So we have industry transformation map for almost every industry, but internationalization cuts across all the industry. So because of our title, International Trading Institute, the first wave of going international is to do trading. But once you've done trading and you know the market, you're also looking for partners to enter into the market, either in the form of a greenfield project, a JV partnership, a franchise, or even a merger and acquisition. So the Singapore SSG, the Skills Future people in the ministry, came to us and said, can you talk to many of the people at the ground on how to grow international and take that ground-up approach instead of top-down and come up with the core skills that allow for people to have eye skills. Eye skills meaning internationalization skills. So we will be announcing something in that line. So you ask me who I am and where I am. I think I am at that sweet spot in education where I can influence partners. I think we are in a sweet spot because a university or any institute of higher learning is seen as a neutral place. And trust is very important to make collaboration work. So I don't have any extra benefit. I don't have a product to sell. I only have students and people and faculty with ideas. So, you know, it makes us very neutral. And it makes our mission also very important because people trust us. So I cannot betray that trust. So when I put my head out that I will try and start a new institute or a new program or a new track, my word is my bond, because that's what forex dealers say. All right, their word is their bond. When I say I'll go for it, I'll do it, I have to do it. I have to make it happen. So I think what is behind this energy and passion is there are people who believe in you. Your team members believe in you. Your collaborators believe in you. And your people believe in you. So I always tell many of our trading partners, right? You gave us support from day one when we were just a blueprint, and you've co-created with us. So this journey is very precious. This trust from you is very precious. So when I launched the Future of Trade book last year, it was on three T's. And the first T is trust. And the second T is talent. And the last T is technology. So we've all come one full circle. Technology is causing us to relook the talent pipeline, but the talent pipeline and its relooking and its retraining cannot happen if you don't trust each other. So let's take this journey together, Radu. Take it with trust, with talent in mind, and take technology by its horn, embrace it, and say, let's turn this into capital, but human capital. Let technology be the driver to make our human capital much more talented and much more ready for the unknown future.
Love it. I will remember the three T's: trust, talent, technology. Very, very relevant. Well, Prof Henny, it's been a pleasure. Your energy has been contagious as ever, and I really want to encourage our audience and people that will be listening and have listened to the podcast to reach out to Prof Henny. Maybe if you're from the private sector, or maybe if you're from a educational institution somewhere around the world, I'm pretty sure that you can build some wonderful collaborations, and you would be open to give advice or anything around that nature. So I do encourage you to do that. And thank you for your time, and good luck with all the many, many projects that you're involved in.
Thank you very much, Radu. My pleasure.
Thank you for listening to our podcast. If you liked what you heard, be sure to follow us on radupalamariu.com/podcast for all the show notes, links, and extra tips covered in the interview. Make sure also to subscribe to our emailing list to get the news in the nick of time. If you're listening through a streaming platform like iTunes or Stitcher and you like what we do, please kindly review and give us 5 stars so we can keep the energy flowing and get more people to find out about our podcast. I'm most active on LinkedIn, so do feel free to follow me to stay tuned for our latest articles as well as future guests for the podcast. And if you have any suggestions or any other idea, please feel free to write to me. I respond to all. And also, please make sure not to miss our next episode, where we will be having a few other C-level and top leaders in supply chain joining us. Stay tuned.